You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're in the thick of a midterm election that will change the course of leadership across California, from governor to Congress and many down-ballot races. As journalists, we often rely on political researchers and election experts to provide deeper context and understanding. And one reliable resource over the years has been the Center for Inclusive Democracy. It's a nonpartisan research center that explores electoral and civic engagement from voting behaviors, voter registration, and the barriers of participating in elections. The center made a big announcement earlier this month. After 15 years of being affiliated with academic institutions like USC and before that UC Davis, it has now transitioned to an independent national organization. Mindy Romero is the founder and the director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy and joins us with what drove this shift. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. So good to be here again.
So you have joined us on many elections here at Cap Radio, as well as at outlets across, you know, the state. But just take us back to the beginning. Why did you create the Center for Inclusive Democracy?
Oh, wow. Well, to be honest, to have impact. I was finishing up my PhD at the time. Don't ask how you can start a research center while you're doing that. But I saw a gap in the field when it came to data, nonpartisan academic research that could inform both policymaking efforts, on the ground efforts, and really focus in and highlight and provide a better understanding around the disparities in participation, why people see barriers to their participation, how we can improve, ultimately improve and make a more representative, robust democracy. There was at times often a mismatch between the research that was out there and what was really accessible and usable and the research questions that were really grounded with how people might use them. And so that's why I started the center.
You're from California. You're from the Central Valley. And in your bio, you write that you were the first in your family to attend college. You were the first to vote. How did those experiences early on in your life, in your youth, early adulthood, shape what you would ultimately devote your career to?
They were everything. So as an academic, we're trained to, of course, not talk about any sort of personal experience, right? We're neutral, we're unbiased in our approach. And of course, I am in my research. But we think we really need to be more open about what really drives us, because especially if you're going to go all the way to get a PhD and devote your career and your time and your energy and all of your probably free time that you could possibly have to doing research, there's something that drives you. And for me, it was looking around the community where I was raised, seeing that there were definitely disparities in how people lived and their life chances. And as I grew older, understanding that it seemed to me, at least as a kid, that the communities that needed the largest voice to have more say, to have more resources, right, allocated, that sort of thing, actually had the lowest voice. They were participating in voting numbers at much lower numbers than other communities and were not going as often, for instance, to a city council or a board of supervisors, right, to have their voice heard. And I wanted to understand the relationship between representation, the barriers that were at play for people, how those could be rectified, of course, within our democracy, and ultimately just to see, you know, a more robust, more participatory, more representative democracy.
Did you always want to keep your research based in California? What stands out to you about the Golden State in terms of voting and elections?
Well, I think for me, I believe that if you're going to be investing your time and academia is investing its time in you into research, that you really owe a public service. Not everybody has to do this, of course, but I think particularly because of my own goals and where I came from, when I got my PhD, I didn't go out on the national job market. I knew that I wanted to continue my research center. It was based, initially it was called the California Civic Engagement Project, you might remember, years ago. At UC Davis, right, at a land grant, you know, public institution. And so I felt if I'm producing this work and we are rooted in California, how could I leave my state? We were of service. People were using our research. We had a responsibility, certainly pretty quickly, pretty early on as the work started to take off and have an impact, right, to my wonderful surprise. So we've always stayed in California. We have grown into a national research center, hence the name change, Center for Inclusive Democracy. But we are still the same entity. And now leaving USC and leaving academia, we're still the same name, the same mission, the same values, very much so. And our move is all about being able to have a greater impact, mm-hmm. to keeping that commitment and that promise in the work.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Even though the name has changed, I mean, you've been at this for 15 years. You founded that center initially in 2011, and at that time, it was a first of its kind research center dedicated to voting and elections data in California. In that time since, just describe some of the work and some of the goals that you have accomplished.
Sure. Well, we've been fortunate to have, I think, a pretty good impact, people tell us. So we have really three buckets of our work. So first and foremost, of course, we're a research center. So our mission is to see the improved quality of life in communities economically, socially, by producing nonpartisan research that informs both, very importantly, policymaking efforts, but also on-the-ground organizing efforts, again, in a nonpartisan way. And we disseminate the research as widely as possible. We've never stayed in our ivory tower, forgive the phrasing. So we aggressively disseminate, make the research accessible, do outreach and education around that work. And we, on those other two buckets, the education work and the kind of direct engagement of community groups and policymakers, we've always done that, but that's actually where we're going to be expanding a lot of our work going forward. So still doing research on things like voting behavior, the barriers to participation, do a lot of research on election reforms, things like campaign finance reform. We have a report coming out next month on that. And also looking forward to seeing where are we going to be in a year or 5 years in terms of our democracy? What are the questions, research questions that we need to be asking now to tackle things like the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act, to tackle things like, you know, what is going to be the capacity of the American people, right, to really be engaged at a level that our democracy will need it to be, right, to recover and to ultimately, hopefully, meet its promise. And then on the engagement part, just disseminating our research much more widely, Well, that too.
Widely, yeah,
yes,
and that too.
Both. Yeah, why not? Just making sure that we are having a wider distribution, dedicated outreach and communications programs to translate that work, to make it more digestible, and then direct engagement of community groups. Again, we've always done some of this, but really in a dedicated way, because really ultimately democracy is local. So the data should be local. And it should be customized, and we need to engage in training and presentations and discussions with local groups to empower their work, again, nonpartisan, but to empower their work so they are being able to track their work, hold themselves accountable in terms of the numbers and that progress, know, you know, where they need to target, where they need to understand their community better. And we, again, think as a public good, we should be doing that work. And of course, we have data tools that are used across the country right now in this election cycle that are all about helping to see a fair and accurate administration of the election that election officials, community groups, leaders use. So we punch above our weight, and we're active in lots of different sorts of ways.
Yeah, obviously, you noticed a gap in something lacking. That's why you created this research institution. But I would imagine during this time, too, you're kind of an ever-evolving student. Like, what have you learned most by having this center and the research and the work that you're doing?
I think first and foremost, it's just how important it is to meet people where they're at. The general public, reporters, media, but very much so policymakers, organizers. There's a lot of assumptions about where the public are, their capacity, their understanding, where policymakers are, what drives them. And I think we've had to be very open, intentionally so and gladly so, to what really are the burning questions, right? That people, not what we want to see as academics, not what the typical journal articles, and yes, we, you know, do journal research as well, but rather, what are the questions on the ground that are really most useful? And we've had to put aside, you know, a lot of the formality and a lot of the kind of assumptions and how academics work, and really meet communities where they're at and respect where they're at, whether it be a high level of knowledge or a low level of knowledge, and fundamentally trust that when sometimes low participation numbers look like people are apathetic, often that'll be the narrative. It's not that people are apathetic. People care deeply about their communities, their kids, their families. If they're not participating, it's often because they don't see how their vote or their participation actually matters and produces an outcome that is good for their communities. Of course, voting does matter, but it's to respect where people are at. That's how you can start to right, not only produce research that is relevant, but also start to produce research that answers those questions, right, that changes some of those numbers.
Right. I mean, calling it apathy is maybe dismissing a group or a block of voters, whereas
Absolutely.
If they're demoralized or, you know,
disconnected,
mm-hmm. then I think you can approach that with more curiosity, like, why is this happening? And as you say, like, meet them where they are to better understand the issues and the disparities.
Exactly. The apathy narrative actually is often used to dismiss, to minimize, right, where people are at. We do this often with young people, right, to just dismiss, you know, their low turnout numbers. Oh, they must be, you know, what's wrong with these kids today, for instance. And it really serves to suppress the vote for many, many communities. It justifies a lack of, if you think about it, investment, right, and policy efforts to try to change the numbers if you think that people are just apathetic, instead of understanding that there are lots of barriers, yes, still, that remain to why people participate, and that it's often quite rational for people in their own equations and their own lives. And we need to meet people, not only meet people where they're at, but really understand how our society is actually letting down people, right, in terms of making the process be something that they really believe in and that they want to participate in.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mindy Romero, the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy. It's a nonpartisan research institution that studies voting behavior in elections and has now gone independent after being affiliated with universities. Okay, so let's get into this. You first were affiliated with UC Davis. Mm-hmm. You then moved to USC. What is the benefit of having these partnerships?
Well, certainly, academia more. So we still consider ourselves very much so an academic research center, right? We are academics producing research with other academics and communities across the country, still going to be working with many universities across the country. We're just not ourselves going to be affiliated with a university. We think that this pathway is the absolute right pathway for us. But if you're at a university, usually you get, you know, a certain infrastructure, right, of support and fellow academics to partner with and to collaborate with. You get a dissemination network right through that university. There's lots of pluses to be at that university. And of course, starting your career and the training academically that you need right through the university system, right? We want to acknowledge that too. But we've also seen that there are barriers today. And there are negatives as well, unfortunately. So now, in this time that we're in, many of our societal institutions are feeling constraints and they're under pressure. Academia, of course, is definitely included in that. And for us to be able to stay true to our mission, our values, who we are, to ensure that the work continues and thrives, we feel that the best approach for us and then what we have done is to be independent of an academic institution, at least for now, so that we are free of any potential pressures, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, did the political climate play a role in wanting to go independent?
Not for us. This has been, again, about greater capacity. I think this is a path that maybe perhaps we were always supposed to be on. And having integrity in the work, making sure that the public understands that we are still very much an academic center, but that we are free to be completely 100% dedicated to our mission, I think is absolutely important in these times. And we've heard a lot of appreciation for what we're doing. We also have heard a lot of appreciation for folks that are still within academia that may be feeling some of there's hard decisions that are being made by universities everywhere, and not every academic or research center or program can go independent. And we hope that we're, in some way, in our small way, right, being an example for a path forward. We are still, it's so important that academia and universities remain a pillar. They are a key pillar to our democracy, to any democracy around the world. And because of those constraints, you know, many universities, not all.
When you say constraints, you mean the Trump administration?
I just mean budget constraints, other sorts of pressures at university. It can vary. But for some universities, that has translated into some difficult decisions, maybe reprioritization of things like individual research or research centers or even student programming, right? We've seen some of that in the news. And I think for us, we see that, we recognize that to continue to be part of that pillar, that very important pillar of academia, that sometimes it means going outside of the institution, of a university institution. So to still contribute, for us, the best way to do that was to be independent and to still serve that important role in our own way.
Yeah, and I bring up the Trump administration because it also can be tied to funding for academic institutions. I mean, the administration, sure, there are many headlines and many articles has been in public battles with some of the top universities in the country, like threatening consequences that can range from pulling research funding to limiting the type of students that can be accepted with visas. You know, some have acquiesced to the demands of the administration, other campuses, they're pushing back, they're in legal battles. Given that you've been in academia for your entire career, that spans presidents, it spans governors, people in positions of power.
You're going to make me sound a little old there,
right?
But that's
okay. No, not at all. That is not my intention. I'm just curious, what stands out to you about this current dynamic?
Well, there's a lot. I'll say that one area that I think we need to just to talk about more is to recognize, again, that there are lots of programs and researchers and centers that may be feeling constraints for all sorts of different reasons, right? Budget or otherwise. And they don't necessarily have a lot of choices in how they adapt. So they either maybe stop their work, maybe they self-censor, maybe they change and modify their mission, and that could be for the better, hopefully not for the worse. Maybe they look different in very significant ways, important ways than they used to look. We're fortunate at CID that we could decide, again, for our own reasons, why we had the capacity and the ability to go independent. So we've always been a self-funded research center. We have a long track record of success, as you just kindly mentioned. We have so many partners over the years that have made that work be impactful. And now we have additional partners that have rallied around us, that stand with us, including, by the way, the Sierra Health Foundation, which, of course, is a locally based philanthropic foundation. They're going to be our fiscal sponsor going forward. So that gives us that fiscal infrastructure that we need to be even more solid as an independent organization. So all of this has come together to make us solid, to allow us to be able to go down this path. And I think there needs to be more conversation and maybe a little bit more kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit to really understand and identify those groups that work, those programs that, you know, are feeling that they have to modify and change and what that means, especially in the democracy space, right? That could be not only disappointing, but maybe even dangerous, right? Maybe groups that feel that they have to be a little less loud or a little bit more quiet, whatever exactly it looks like. So those are the things that are on my mind, and I certainly hear it from colleagues around the country that aren't on radio stations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah. I was going to ask, is this a big topic of conversation among you and your colleagues across the country?
It's a quiet topic of conversation. As I said, I think, again, the constraints can vary, right? We just know that they're there in different sorts of ways. I've heard from many, many colleagues, and I think certainly our announcement, I've had colleagues that reached out that are excited that we can do this and they wish they could do the same. But again, they maybe don't have that infrastructure, or yet they don't have it yet. And that's why we're hoping that maybe the bottom line for us was it was about the work. It was about the capacity. It was continuing the work in the way that we absolutely could have the biggest impact and being true to who we were. And hopefully in some way, we're also able to shine a light for this path for others as well.
What has
and by the way, it's exciting, too. It's very exciting.
Yeah,
for us.
It's a new chapter.
Yes,
right?
We're very, very excited. Yeah.
You know, what has USC said about your center leading the university?
So I can't speak for USC, nor should I. What I can say is what the university president said recently at an event that they hosted up here, at the Capitol. He said, as I understand it, that the university has faced a pretty significant structural deficit in the last year, and that the university, as well as the school, had to make some difficult budget decisions. At the same time, though, I should note that he apparently praised us effusively, acknowledged our standing in the field and our long impact and our reputation currently as well. And as I understand it, the university is very glad that our work is continuing. There was never ever a possibility that it wasn't going to, of course, continue to thrive and grow. We are all, myself and CID period, we are deeply committed to this work. But as we understand it, they are happy and excited for the fact that our work is continuing.
So being affiliated with a university like USC, are they a big financial backer to a center like yours?
Well, there are certainly resources that you get at university, like we talked about earlier, right? That you get at a university, right? Media support, infrastructure, right? In terms of managing things like grants and certainly HR for employees, all sorts of things. And you get a network that is incredibly important, especially for major universities, right? Like UC Davis and USC. We have always been a self-funded research center, so we're proud of that and stood on our own 2 feet in terms of that. But certainly there, again, I can't speak for the whole picture, but certainly there are other costs. And we do certainly lose some things by not being at a major university. But like I said, for us, it's about a trade-off and the ability to expand and grow, again, to further grow our mission and our work.
Well, finally, Mindy, what does the future look like?
Great. I keep saying that we're excited, but we're also excited. I mean, really, honestly, this is an earnest endeavor, right? This is a serious time that we're in. Our democracy has been under significant challenge in so many different ways. So we take our small part of that pie in trying to do what we can as researchers, right, and as partners with others to address the challenges in our democracy. So it's a serious endeavor, but we're also excited about being kind of free to take the pathways as we see them. And already so many different partnerships are emerging that we never thought about before. And it's amazing how sometimes partnerships don't come about because you are at a university and people think that you have a certain kind of structure, you work a certain kind of way, or you have a certain type of, certain type of resources or partnerships already kind of set. And now independent, people have really come to us to be excited about the work and wanting to be involved in different sorts of ways, which makes it stronger, which builds a much stronger, ultimately, foundation to the work. More perspectives, more talent, more skills, more resources, and most importantly for me, we partner with people who are deeply committed and organizations and communities that are deeply committed to seeing change. And it's been just wonderful already in a short amount of time. We made this announcement actually back initially in May, and people are excited for us and excited about the impact we can have.
Mindy, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me again.
Mindy Romero is the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy. It's a nonpartisan research institution that studies voting behavior in elections. It has now gone independent after being affiliated with universities, most recently USC, and prior to that, UC Davis. Still ahead, we're in the dog days of summer, but for animal shelters, this time of year means one thing. Kittens. As temperatures rise, shelters are seeing a surge in newborn cats. We'll talk to the Sacramento SPCA about kitten season. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.